Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Hello. Welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now Scan Radio Show number 2405, presented by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, NASCA. My name is Joe Kalk, calling in from the beautiful Oregon coast. I am an adult survivor of child abuse, and I will be your host this evening. We have a very special guest, so I welcome you to call in to be on our panel at 646-595-2118. I think you will enjoy this show. But first, I want to talk to you a little bit about NASCA. The National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse is a nonprofit 501c3 organization which is self-supporting through our own contributions. Our focus is on child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. Tax-deductible donations are gladly received. We have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two specific perspectives. One, educating the public, especially to move society beyond the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse by presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Tonight's special guest is Andrew Perry. He's a licensed clinical social worker from the Antelope Valley area of Los Angeles. He's a returning NASCA family member who is a founder and executive director of Sexual Assault Awareness. Please call in at 646-595-2118. I think you will find this a very important show tonight. All right, and I am now going to talk with Andrew. Hi, Andrew. How are you tonight?
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on again. And thank you to Bill.
You're welcome.
Bringing me back again and again.
Well, we're glad to have you back, and I just wanted to briefly explain a little bit about the format for those who aren't familiar and are listening in. We generally have you just relate your story starting from childhood, going through about 15 to 20 minutes. Then we break for the panel to ask questions or give you feedback, and then we continue. Since you've been on before, if you are welcome to abbreviate or shorten the introductory part so that we can get to at least half the time on your sexual assault awareness and what you're doing now. Does that sound all right?
Sure. That sounds great.
Okay. All right, good.
This is actually really interesting for me because I don't know, Joe, if you were on or on the panel for the last two shows, but the first time I was on was with Bill and the second time with Deborah. And both of those times, I think I mentioned or referenced that I did have a personal history, but I really didn't go into it because I was there to talk about other things. So we kind of skipped over that piece. And so this is a really interesting time because just a week ago, 2 weeks ago, my book, Me Too, Counselors and Psychotherapists Speak About Sexual Violence and Abuse, was released through PCCS Books. And I have a chapter in that book. It's a compendium, so there's a number of different therapists who write their personal stories. And it's the first time, and I'm in my mid-50s now, but it's the first time I've ever put my story out there outside of close family members, friends. I occasionally will disclose clients. I'm a psychotherapist, and I do sexual assault trauma recovery work, primarily with women. And so occasionally, you know, if I thought it would move treatment forward, I might do some personal disclosure. But for the most part, for most of my life outside of my own therapy, I really haven't said anything about it. So what I thought might be interesting, if you are okay with it and your listeners, is I thought I might read an excerpt from the chapter that I wrote.
Oh, sounds good. All right. Go right ahead.
A little bit of a preview of what's in the book. So I just pulled this out because I think this piece, I was kind of reading through it again earlier today, and this piece kind of speaks to a lot of where I stand. So I'm often asked at conferences how I got into this, why I do this work, why I do the work that I do on behalf of female survivors. And I'll talk about a documentary on teen prostitution that I saw as a teenager, and how seeing girls my age being exploited woke me up to how the world treats women. My realization at 19 that this world of 7+ billion humans has historically discriminated against one entire half of the population, and that as a man, I have some power to shift that. Or my very first therapy client in my early 20s who disclosed to me for the first time her adolescent rape, and our work through her trauma to the end told me I had a gift and should consider this as my path. Or my ongoing discovery of my ability to help women talk and heal from their trauma, and the open pursuit in tackling aspects of sexual assault that my profession still won't talk openly about. I've had numerous experiences leading me towards the work that I do now. But what I don't talk about is my own personal awakening. What I don't mention is my own experience being sexually harmed by someone close to me for years as a teenager. This book gives me another opportunity to help others through my journey from slumber into daylight. And then I go in and I do talk about that. The title of the chapter is called While I Was Sleeping, and that's a prominent theme both in my abuse but also in my life, because my abuser, who I don't name, and I take care not to name or gender them in my chapter, because and I'll talk about this a little bit. But during my teen years, this person would come into my room and molest me while they thought I was sleeping. And so I would pretend to wake up. I would roll over. Sometimes I would sleep and not be aware anything was happening until I woke up and it was happening. And this went on for several years. And this was a person who I was close to, who I considered a friend and someone who cared about me. And it was all very disturbing and very confusing, as I know, you know, all the listeners here know, and the people who are on the show. But what was a little different, I think, about my situation is I didn't talk about it or say anything about it until I was in my 30s. And at that time, I was an established therapist, and I thought, you know, it's not something I blocked out or forgot. I was always aware of it. And I thought, this is something I really need to deal with. If I'm going to do this work, I need to kind of own my own stuff. And so I went to therapy, and I'd been to therapy before, but this was the first time that I had ever disclosed. But I went specifically in order to talk about this. And she had me start journaling. And unfortunately, I kept my journal. I was married at the time. I was within the first year or two of my marriage. And I kept my journal because I didn't see any reason to hide it. I kept it in the drawer next to my bed. Well, my wife and I were going through some difficult moments, and I talk about this in the chapter, and she found my journal and read what I had written in it, and at first was really guilty and upset that she had violated my privacy, but then that turned into demanding that I deal, that I confront the abuser, because the abuser had children of their own. And she was concerned of what they might do and where that might go. And so it ended up getting opened up very to my family, to my abuser, to, you know, a number of friends and people in our circle. And the story was out of my control. And I write in the chapter about something I think is really significant, which is the importance of control over our story. Because as we all know, power and control is taken from us when we're abused. And the ability to tell our story and to release our story in the way that we need to, I think, is vitally important. And that was, you know, another piece in this chapter that I wrote about how that that control, again, was taken away from me, not just by my wife, but then by my family, who wanted me to handle it a certain way, do things their way. And I'm in my 30s and I'm a therapist, and I'm sitting there going, that's not the appropriate way to deal with this, because I'm already working with people. And I know you have to allow the person to have control over their story. And I labeled that that behavior silent violence, because it's a different kind of violence in addition to the original abuse and the original assault. And it's the pressure from society, from family, from friends to handle your abuse, rape, assault in the way that they find comfortable or in the way that they find meaningful. And I think many, many survivors go through this and are subject to this, what I call silent violence, of being made to do things according to someone else's agenda. And they may think they're doing the right thing. They may think they're being supportive. They, you know, I think my wife thought she was helping me, but helping me to, you know, come out about it, and couldn't hear me say, not the right way, not the right time, not like this. And it created a lot of trouble later in our marriage, and ultimately, I mean, not just that piece, but ultimately led to our divorce many years later. But I think that's a that's an important piece of this, is that that kind of silent pressure, that silent violence that I think a lot of victims and survivors experience in, you know, once people start to know, or if they disclose, they're now subject to this other person's view rather than an openness of, how can I help you? How can I help you tell the story that you need to, if you're even wanting to do that? So I went through many years of substance abuse, not addiction, fortunately, but abuse in recovery, and a lot of therapy and getting out on the other end of it. And the thing that I think is really, that I still feel privileged about, is I was able to come back to my abuser, and we were able to sit down and work through what had happened. And they took responsibility and apologized for what they had done. And that's one of the reasons why I don't care to name or disclose who they are, what their gender was, or even, you know, what role they played in my life. Because they did come back, and they did, you know, own that and do the work with me, and went to their own therapy and was able to have that conversation. So I talk in the chapter about how privileged, as odd as it may seem to use that word, that compared to many survivors, to have that experience of, to have an abuser take responsibility to apologize, I think is a rare thing. And I do feel very lucky to have had that experience. And I'm still in contact with that person to this day. We still chat from time to time, and they're still a part of my life.
Wow, that is great. That is great. Okay, is this a good time to break and go through the panel? Have them ask some questions, get them introduced. Okay, if you want to be on the panel, please call 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And we'll go first to Dr. Deb. Hi, Dr. Deb. You're on.
Hi.
You're on with Andrew.
Dr. Deb.
I am on with Andrew. I told you I'd call in, honey.
How are you doing?
Good. I am, and thank you for telling me your story. That was, you know, very hard to do, and I'm honored that I know that now about you.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, we've known each other for a number of years, and it really isn't something that I've chosen to talk about professionally. And I talk about that actually in the book as well, about my choice to not do that because, and I say this with all due respect, because I know you work primarily with male survivors, I work primarily with female survivors, but I look very much at the kind of global dominance of men over women. In that sense. And so I've made a choice in my own narrative to kind of pull back a little bit. And I realize, you know, male survivors is an important issue and it's something that that needs to be addressed. But in terms of the work I do, because I work primarily with girls and women, unless I feel it's really relevant to their work, it's not something I've really chosen to center until now. And if I hadn't been invited by the editors of this book to write this, I still may not have done that, but they reached out to me and we had a talk and they felt it was really important to tell this story. So I agreed and I thought it was part of my own journey, my own healing.
Good. All right. Dr. Deb, do you have any questions or are you ready to move on?
No, let's move on. Let's see who else is on the panel.
Oh, okay. All righty.
Are we going to talk about our work?
Okay. Oh, just a minute. Put her back on. Go ahead.
I was just saying to Deborah, if we're going to talk about our work,
yeah,
that we do together.
Okay. Well, probably
we come
in
back
the next
to that.
Round. So probably, yeah. Okay. And now we have Bill. He's our founder and president. It's also a wonderful last-minute trailer for me, and I really appreciate his help. All right, Bill, you're on with Andrew.
Yeah, hi, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, and thank you again for reaching out to me. I really appreciate that. You've always been a big supporter of my work, and I always appreciate coming on the show.
Of course. We want people to return who've been on the show before, and kind of catch us up with maybe where they are today. Maybe you've learned some stuff or you've had some experiences and so forth. But again, to showcase you as a professional, not everybody's a survivor, but we have a big cadre of survivors listening tonight who are going to listen intently and perhaps learn something, I'm sure, from what you have to share. So really appreciate you being here, Andrew, and I'll be included in the round of panelists as we go through the night. So thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you, Bill. Okay. And next we have Johnny Rock. And John, hi. You're on with Andrew.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing okay.
Great. I'm the Louisiana ambassador, Vanessa, and glad to have you on the show tonight. I'm really interested in the topic. I read the description. I really want to pay attention and listen tonight, but I wanted to call in just in case I had a question. So I don't want to miss out on that opportunity. It's good to be here.
Cool.
And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. And next we have Darlene from Tennessee. Hi, Darlene. You're on with Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Darlene.
It is so awesome hearing that you were able to confront and work it out with the person that molested you. That is a privilege to be able to do that. I'm glad that you did.
Yeah. No, I was very fortunate. It wasn't easy. It went over years. There was a lot of therapy, a lot of conversation, a lot of working things out, a lot of kind of going back to that time that was obviously painful for me, but as I learned, painful for the other person as well in terms of what they were going through. And so one of the things that I talk about is, as much as I needed them to hear me and hear my experience, I learned that I also needed to listen as well to gain an understanding, because that was what was most important to me, was to understand how and why all of that happened.
Right. I got a question for you.
Sure.
Are y'all still friends today, even though that you worked it out, or did you just say, well, it's just best?
The person's a part of my life. Friends probably isn't the right word, but they're a part of my life. We're friendly, certainly.
Okay.
And we have contact with each other. I know their family. They know mine.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Darlene.
Sure.
Thank you, Darlene. All right. Okay. Now, people, if you want to join in, 646-595-2118. Come on and call in. All right, Andrew, we're back to you. And we have an hour and a half total, so we've got another hour at least. And so just pick up wherever you'd like to pick up from now.
Well, gosh. We have to go in a lot of directions. I do a lot of different I provide psychotherapy. I do research. I do a national and international talks, primarily around, and this is what I've talked on the show about before, about the issue of arousal, orgasm and arousal for victims of sexual assault. And it's really still a very under-discussed, not well-known topic. And it's a subject of huge shame and guilt for a lot of survivors. And it's one that I've been aware of for many, many years. I've been talking about this for at least the past 10 years. And you know, there's kind of almost three different levels that I encounter when I do talks. There's the people, and I know Bill and I have talked about this before, where it was sort of a that's obvious kind of a moment. So I run into people who like immediately get it and will say, well, yeah, that makes sense. If you're being, whether you hate it or not, if you're being sexually stimulated, you're going to have a response to that. And many children and many adult survivors go through that as well. And then I run into kind of the opposite camp, the people who that never occurred to and who never, like, thought about that, especially survivors. You know, I run into that a lot, which are like they lived in shame and guilt and secrecy around that aspect of their abuse and never thought it was okay to talk about or even had gone to therapy and been told by therapists that, well, that means if that happened, then it wasn't really abuse, it wasn't really a rape, it wasn't really molestation. And I've run into that many times where I've had people encounter me and say, you're the first person I've ever talked to who made it okay to talk about this.
Wow.
So I've told the story on this show before how a number of years ago I was having a conversation with a female colleague who I greatly respect, and I won't name her. But we were having a discussion about a client, and I was seeking out their counsel about an issue I was having in therapy with one of my clients. And in the course of talking about the client, talking about the narrative, I mentioned that they had had an arousal response during their rape. And her response was, oh, well, that's the key issue, because she subconsciously wanted it to happen. And that's why she had that response. And I'm sitting there, and I already know about the physiology and the neurobiology. And I'm like, no, that's not really true. That's not what happens. But it kind of blew my mind that this is someone in the field who does this work, and that was her response. And it kind of sent me back going through all of the texts, all of the books on sexual abuse and sexual assault that I had read, where I thought they talked about this issue, and realize that there is almost nothing in the literature about the experience of arousal and orgasm for survivors of sexual assault. There's maybe a line or two. I think in one book there was a very brief chapter that goes into it. And that was about it. And this is going on 10 years ago now, really blew my mind. And so I started talking about it publicly. I started putting together presentations and talking about it. And the more I talked about it, the more I was invited to talk about it. And that kind of became my thing. And that's what I'm nationally known for. I don't know if you're familiar with Emily Nagowski in Canada. She's a sex educator, and she talks about that. In fact, she had a really excellent TED Talk a year or two ago about it. And that was the only other professional that I've seen talk about it in a very public way. And people have told me that I'm the American Emily Nagowski, or she's the Canadian me, or something like that. I don't know which.
Wow.
So I started doing, the presentations and the talks and research where I did a lot of qualitative interviews with women who had had that experience and used that data. And about 3 or 4 years ago, a graduate student at one of my talks came up afterwards and said, "What's the research on this?" And I said, "Well, there's one piece of research out of England that's now about 15, 16 years old. I think it was 2004. And all it did was validate that this is an experience that happened. It didn't even have very much data, very low N. And she said, "Well, I want to do something with this." And it became her graduate dissertation. And just in the last couple of months, she completed her dissertation on the experience for women of arousal during sexual assault. And we looked at a number of different markers about reporting characteristics. How likely were they to report, not report, if they had an arousal experience during their sexual assault or rape? We looked at some emotional factors, spikes of anxiety and depression. And really proud to say that she completed this. Her name is Kayla Bunderson, out of Alliant University, and she completed her doctorate, and this was her seminal piece. So I haven't had a chance to really start talking about it, but it's the first research, certainly in the U.S., ever done on this topic.
Wow. Oh, congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, she did the work. I just mentored it. But I was really pleased to see that happen.
That is great. Okay. Does this sound like a good breaking point for another round of panel discussion?
Sure.
Or do you have a little bit more? Okay.
I have lots more, but
keep interrupting.
Why don't we do a round breaking comeback?
Sorry?
I said I have lots more, but let's do a round come back.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I'm not cutting you off. I'm just saying, if this is a good chance to get it back in. Okay, Dr. Deb, you're back on with Andrew.
I am back on with Andrew. Listening to you talk, I mean, we were just talking about something that we're working on together. Do you want to talk about that? Because then people can meet you and also talk about these things with you in person.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to tribute Dr. Deborah right now. She is putting together, her company is putting together a series of educational tours where the speaker, in this case myself, and there's a number of other people, put together a tour around a topic of interest and then tie it together with a regional experience. And so going somewhere in the world that may have some connection to that idea or that topic, and doing some experiential touring, and then some lecturing and interactive work around whatever the topic is. And so, for example, Dr. Deborah had an experience where she did a whole thing on gun violence and was able to go to France, was it?
Yeah, we're supposed to go to France in October.
Right.
But she did that in New Zealand. Yeah. But let's make this about you, because you were in sexual assault.
right. So we're in talks right now about how to tie the work that I do into that kind of regional educational tour. So we would go on a tour for, say, a week. We'd visit some place really interesting, have some, wonderful dining and some wonderful, maybe museum or some kind of interactive experience, and tie that into the topic of the work. So in this case, sexual assault, something related to sexual assault, trauma recovery, that kind of thing, and maybe visiting somewhere in the world where there's some other interesting speakers that we could tie in and make a whole event out of it. That's very exciting stuff.
Wow.
It is so exciting. And one of the things that's exciting about it is that you hear Andrew on the radio show and he's at my annual script conference, but you get to spend like a whole week with him learning about all the things that he has knowledge of and interacting with him for a week in a different setting that is particularly heightened in that part of the world or just connects with it, which is amazing, And so him talking about it, his book, like all of that coming out, you'll get to meet him and be able to ask questions like all the time. So sometimes you meet a speaker for 1 hour and you're like, "Oh my God, I had all those questions," and then you never get them answered.
Right.
Well, you have a whole week to pick his brain.
So I'll be getting calls in my hotel room at 4 in the morning. I have a question for you, Andrew.
Oh, I didn't pick up that it was that the guests or the people were going to be there the whole week with you. I thought you were gaining the experience yourself, and then we're talking about. Oh my goodness! Wow.
No. I'm glad Deborah said that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea is to have a small group tour, so maybe 20 people would be part of this tour. So it's intimate, it's small. It's an opportunity to interact directly with the speaker. And to be able to talk with them more in detail. So, you know, someone comes to, a seminar I give or these days during COVID, a webinar, and, you know, they might have an hour and a half, 2 hours to, you know, have that experience. This is going to be a week's worth of much deeper interaction and ability to answer questions and talk about things in a much more detailed way and in a small enough group that everyone can benefit together from that.
Wow, a real immersion then in that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea.
Yeah.
Wow, thank you. And thank you for bringing that up, Dr. Depp. That sounds good.
And if people want to find out about it, they can go to my website, drdeborahwarner.net, and we'll be putting up Andrew's information and all of the information about the tour. It'll be under a tab called Discovery Tours. And so that will be launching very soon. But until then, you can just go to drdeborahwarner.net or you can talk to Andrew. Andrew, what is your information so they can reach out to you?
Well, my website is www.saawareness.com, which stands for Sexual Assault Awareness. As Joe said at the top of the show, that's the name of my agency, Sexual Assault Awareness. So people look for... They look for my name, Andrew Parry, and it's spelled P-A-R-I, like Paris, France, without the S, and then Sexual Assault Awareness. They'll find my website. They'll probably find a whole lot of talks and different things, but they'll find the website.
Cool. Thank you, and thank you both for
that. You're reminding me, Deborah, that I need to update my website so I can include your information on my website.
Absolutely. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But I did also have a question for you, too. You know, I hear you talk so brilliantly about, you know, how you dealt with this and you got therapy and how this person is still around in your life. One of the things that people don't realize is sometimes when this happens, you do run into the abuser. You do run into the person in your life. And you were able to get, I don't even want to say it's closure, but you were able to come to a place of, you know, being in that and not having it trigger you as much. How would you tell someone else to get to that point? Like, what would your advice be as a professional and someone who went through that?
Well, just to back up a second, I think closure is actually, in my specific case, the right word. And I say that in part because I think it's important to highlight how unusual my situation is compared to a lot of people, that I was able to have that. But when I talk with clients about that who have that desire, I think first it starts from that desire that they want to have that connection with the person, that they want to understand, that they want that level of insight. I certainly work with people who, you know, can say that person can rot in prison for all I care. I never want to see them, know them again. And other people who have a very different take. It was important to me to do that work. So that's where that desire comes from. So I think it's important first to identify what does the person want. If they're saying, I want to heal, but I don't want nothing to do with that person, that's certainly doable. And I do that kind of work all the time. But if someone says, this is what I want to have a connection with, whether it was, you know, abusive father or mother, neighbor, whoever it was, that they want to have that, then we begin a dialogue around what would that look like? What's their vision of how that would go? And then we start talking about how would you want that contact to happen? What would you want it to look like? And one of the things I talk about is, and we talk about letter writing and conversations a lot, and writing a letter that deals with anger and hurt and betrayal is one kind of animal, but writing a letter that invites the abuser back into their life to have a dialogue around the abuse is a very different thing. And it can sometimes be a much more challenging and painful thing because the person needs to do the work to come to a point where they can sit with that other person or write with them or, you know, whatever method that they're envisioning that would happen. But if they're, let's say, for example, they're wanting to sit down in person with that person, there's a lot of work that goes into making sure they're safe, making sure that they have an escape plan if it gets too overwhelming, and then also being open to hearing the other person's experience, which is ultimately what they're wanting, but that can be really painful to hear. And so there's a lot of work that goes into building the person's ego, esteem, up to the point that they're able to tolerate that communication if that's really what they're wanting. Does that answer your question, Deborah?
Yeah, it does. It answers it a lot. And, I'm hoping people hear that, you know, I do that letter a lot with people, but what's unique about the one you're talking about, it's not from a place of anger. It's from a place of trying to heal and trying to understand and opening a dialogue. And most people don't want to open that dialogue because it's too painful.
Right.
It takes so much strength to do that. It takes so much inner strength and bravery, I want to say, to step into that. And so, I just admire you for being able to do that and being able to share that because it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and it's a very different kind of work, you know, and I have, you know, gone from, well, I just want to journal about this and write my narrative, and that sometimes morphs into a realization of wanting to have that potential for healing. And that's the other piece is the survivor may be reaching out and the other person may not reach back. And that's another piece that happens or certainly may not reach back in the way that they're hoping. So, you know, I've worked with people through those kinds of experiences where they write that initial letter or they try to do that initial phone call and it's not met with anything. And then we have to do a different kind of healing to help them work through that.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, I was going to ask about that if it goes south. You're there to help them through that disappointment.
Yeah, that's what I call the escape plan is how are we going to make sure you have something in place before you even start the engagement? How do we make sure you have something in place so you can step out of it if you need to? Even if it's stepping out of it for 10 minutes to do some grounding work so you can step back in. But if you're really feeling like the person is not listening to you or they're continuing the abuse, which can happen as well, they're blaming the victim, that kind of thing, you know, that's the time to just cut it off and have a positive escape plan, have somewhere to go, have a supportive person ready to meet with them, or in some cases I'll have, if I know that this is something we've been working up to, I'll make myself available on the day that they're doing that. So if they need to call me and talk to me, they can do that.
That's good. All right. Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Deb. That was great. Okay. Let's go on to Bill. Let's get him on here. Our president and founder. Hi, Bill. You're on with Andrew.
Yeah. I have a number of things here, and I'm going to go through them quickly. First of all, at Andrew's request, I had inserted the web address as sexualassaultawareness.org, and he said it was SA awareness, I think, but it's probably an either-or thing, right? So
it's the first one you mentioned is the older one, but it does reroute, but the current one is saawareness.com.
Okay, but that's the one that you had specifically given me to put there, so that's what's there, and it still works at the point. All right, so that's under his name and under sexual assault awareness in the hyperlinks in the bio. Second thing is, boy, I wish I could go on that trip, but, you know, that's never going to happen for me. And thirdly, you know, we have talked about the sexual arousal stuff. I've been talking about it for many, many years, and I was talking about it really from the beginning of my recovery because I realized I was chasing the sensation. I was one of those people. Of course, I'm male, but I was a male who was prepubescent when he was molested and fondled and so forth. And I could not ejaculate, but I could have the experience, the sensation, the tingling sensation, if you know what I mean, Andrew, that you get from ejaculation. And I could have that sustained for 10 minutes, 20 minutes at a time. It was unbelievable. And I was chasing that from then on, because that only occurs, or at least for me, when you're prepubescent. And shortly after that first set of periods of time that happened, I started to mature enough to start grow hair and so forth. I started to, my body did change. And from then on, I ejaculated kind of normally, if you want. But the sensation, I chased after the sensation. I was hooked to it, no question. So it was part of the grooming process is the way I look at it for me. You know, I loved it. Who doesn't love it, right? so that's,
you know,
that's
that,
my thought on that. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say that that takes me to a whole other thing that I'm going to talk about later in the show. But there's a really powerful thing with what you're talking about there that's led to some later research and some stuff I've done just in the last year. And we'll come back around to that.
Mm. Well, I've been talking about it for 30-something years. I talked about it without knowing you weren't supposed to talk about it. I didn't care. I talked about the truth, you know.
which is exactly how you should talk about it.
Of course, yeah. All right, now, the thing I really want to ask you a question about is, you said that you were able to, in the process of working with the person that was your predator, find out what was behind the reasons and the whys and the wherefores and the hows and stuff from that person's perspective. I understood you to say, if that's true, I'd be really interested in hearing what it was. And I got to say, as a caveat to most people who are listening, don't expect this experience. The vast majority of people will never, never get what they think they need from their predator, ever. Including even a simple apology.
But no, and that's why I make such a point about saying it's such a rarity.
It is very, very, very rare. But can you tell me, though, what you did discover about the wherefores and whys of that person's background or why they'd done it to you?
To an extent. I mean, they suffered from a lot of self-esteem issues. They had a lot of inadequacy, which, I mean, some of this is pretty – you know, if you do this work, pretty common knowledge in terms of why predators do what they do comes from a very empty place inside themselves. And this person was the same. They had grown up with a very low sense of themselves, low self-esteem. Whether there was abuse in their background or not, I don't know, and that's not something that we got into. It's something I think I touched on at one point and just sort of said, this may be true for you. A lot of personal inadequacy, and then there was also sexual inadequacy, and I think they felt like they were fulfilling something or exploring something by molesting me and by doing what they did with me, some sort of self-affirmation, self-discovery. It wasn't because of the way that it happened. It was at night. They thought I was asleep. It didn't have the kind of power and control. I wasn't forced in the sense of, being held down or being verbally coerced or intimidated or threatened with the relationship or threatened in many incest cases, threatened with the loss of the love of the parent or that kind of thing. That was not a piece of my experience. That domination piece wasn't really a part of it. There was definitely that sense of inadequacy and loss of power for them.
Yeah, and it's about, as we know, most of the time, it's about power and control. It's not about sex at all. That all makes sense to a lot of the listeners, and we've talked about this many, many times. The thing that won't make sense is the forgiveness part of it that I hear in you, because an awful lot of people, we can forgive them on the level of their being human, and we all have faults, that kind of thing. But we also are mostly told, and the studies do show, that most predators have many victims, not just one occasion. And, you know, part of the hope for, I think, a person that would be doing this would be to get them to, of course, admit it and apologize and so forth, but also say, like you do any amends, that you're not going to ever do it again. And I don't know if that's even believable. I mean, I have to say it honestly. That's my thought. But thanks, Andrew.
Yeah,
you're doing great. A lot of interesting topics here.
Yeah. A lot of directions to go in. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. All right, let's go now to Johnny Rock. Johnny, you're on with Andrew.
Thank you. I want to thank Bill for bringing the subject of sexual arousal back into the topic, because that's really what I unfortunately, I've never heard Bill talk about that. I've missed those shows. And for me, the sexual arousal and the pleasure that I experienced as a child, I never felt shame because I didn't know that what was happening was wrong, because there was never any pain. It was just pleasure, and it was attention. And even in my younger teens, when it was still going on, I still didn't know that it was wrong. I had suspicions that I was starting to realize, hey, this might not be right. But that pleasure and arousal turned into an addiction. And mm-hmm. the addiction, I wasn't able to experience pleasure by having any kind of real romantic, intimate relationships. So the shame for me was because I was addicted to it, and it couldn't be intimate, and I couldn't have a real relationship. So it was, you know, deviant and perversions and stuff like that. That's where all the shame mm-hmm. came from. And it's irrelevant whether or not I forgave my abusers, which were many, 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 but the forgiveness needs, which I think maybe still, I still haven't forgiven myself completely, which is why I was drawn to this show tonight. So you said you were going to, Andrew, you said you were going to talk more about it later in the show, and the show's half over, so I want to shut up and let you get to that, and I'm going to go ahead and get off the phone so I can just listen, because this is kind of triggering for me, and I just want to go on a patio and smoke a cigarette and listen. So thank you for being on the show, and I'm going to go now.
All right. Thank you, Johnny. Thanks for raising that.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Okay. And now we go to Darlene in Tennessee. Darlene, you're on with Andrew.
Hello. I'm just so glad that I am listening tonight, and I'm learning a lot more information about the different things that are coming up around. So thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You're
okay.
Welcome.
Did you
You're
have
welcome.
Any questions or anything? Or should we continue?
No, just continue.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Now, if you want to call in, 646-595-2118. We have about 40 minutes left, so you have time. 646-595-2118. All right, Andrew, it's back to you, and where are we going now?
And there's no commercials, so we have plenty of time.
No commercials. Nope.
No sponsor breaks. No. So, you know, I'm really glad that both Bill and then Johnny kind of cycled back around to the arousal piece. And Johnny's experience, having had that as a young boy and not having a shameful association, is something that I see as well. And so this stuff, as we all know, can get very complicated in terms of the individual psyche and how we work through this. But when I'm looking at arousal, I kind of break it into a number of camps, and one is the one that Johnny just talked about, which is having the experience tied to the positive feeling, but without the guilt and the shame. But those experiences are still tied together in something that I call linking, that we link the abuse and the abusive experiences and the memories around those to the feelings that we have at the time, and then we carry those forward in our life. And so there's the experience that that John talked about, but then there's also, of course, the very shameful, guilty, depressive, you know, angry kind of experience of feeling those arousal feelings while going through the abuse, and that gets linked and tied together in a very profound way. It's I talk about, I'm not going to go too much into the science of it here, but in my lectures I do a lot of talk about neurobiology, neuroscience, the primal brain versus the higher functioning, executive functioning brain, and how those kind of work together. But I think one of the key pieces that is important to talk about is what we experience at the time of the abuse versus our view of it later on. And that's often where kind of that shame, guilt piece comes in. I call it then and now brain. There is the primal experience of what we went through and the arousal and all of that. And then there's looking back and trying to make sense of it. And oftentimes, in an effort to reassert our own control, the way we make sense of it is to blame ourselves. And that's where a whole lot of self-blame and self-responsibility for sexual abuse, rape, sexual assault comes from, is because we're looking back and, you know, unless you're educated in this stuff, we don't know the neuroscience or how hormones get activated. And that's not something that we really learn about. And so we're left with this, well, I came during the experience, and that is generally associated with positive sexual feelings, so that must mean I liked it or I wanted it. And that's often the conception people come to, but it's a false conception. It's not a real conception. It's what our analytical brain does with the information when we are out of that trauma. Because when we're in the trauma, in those moments, our higher brain is not available to us. It shuts down. And so if you kind of do any reading on trauma, when we're in a traumatic state, not just sexual, but, you know, we're mugged or we're in a car accident or any kind of traumatic situation, we're completely relying on our survival instincts, our flight and fight instincts, as they're called. And so our higher brain, our ability to think and reason and analyze, all of that is offline and not available to us. But then later on, in the days or weeks that follow, it comes back online, and now we're trying to make sense of this experience. And the way to make sense of it is, well, how can I make myself as much in control as possible, because then maybe I can figure out a way to not have that happen again. And again, those are false beliefs. They're false cognitions. It's not really true. But one of the aspects of that that I've been looking into in these last couple of years are – And Bill talked about this a little bit, and so he may be able to relate to this, but this idea of chasing that high in the years afterwards. And I've, in just the last 2-3 years, interviewed a number of women who, as adults, and some of them are victims of child sexual abuse, some of them had teen or adult experiences where they were raped. But what they found was the intensity of that experience was so overwhelming that they sought out ways to recapture that in their lives, either with partners or with hookups, sometimes to the extreme of putting themselves in very similar situations to what they went through. And there's an online community that I've done a lot of this work and a lot of the interviews on. And I'll say the name of it. It's kind of a touchy name. But it's a very kind of BDSM kink-oriented community called Rape Kink. And it's a community of largely women who are kind of re-seeking both these experiences but also seeking to understand those experiences. And the people who run that community have been very gracious to me and allowed me to come in and do a lot of interviews and a lot of working with the women there. To talk about these experiences and what drives them and what causes them to seek those out. And one of the things that I identify, because I think in hearing this, it's, you know, it's probably very shocking to a lot of people and very upsetting. Like, why would someone who's been through something so difficult and so painful go ahead and seek it out? But there's a concept in psychology called repetition compulsion, and it comes with trauma, that when we have a traumatic experience, in trying to make sense of that experience, we will sometimes go back through and re-engage in some way with elements of that experience. So that's what these women are doing, is trying to understand what they're going through in that. And what I discovered, and initially I was just fascinated that this was happening, and so I started my interviews from that, like, just tell me about this kind of experience you're going through. But the more I talked to them, one of the things that started to come up was that when they engaged in those experiences, they experienced a decrease in the anxiety and depression and a lot of the trauma symptoms that we often see in survivors. Sometimes it didn't last very long, sometimes it lasted a while, but many of them were experiencing a trauma symptom reduction, and I thought that was fascinating. So I started to focus in on that and conduct interviews around that experience. And what I found was that when they had some level of insight and knowledge about why they were doing what they're doing, their symptom reduction would be greater. If they were just kind of doing it unconsciously without really understanding why, and they were just sort of chasing that high, chasing that experience, that wasn't as true. And out of all of that work, what I was able to do was put together the beginnings of a treatment recovery model that I call guided rape exposure treatment. And it's rooted in the principles of prolonged exposure, which is probably one of the most effective and researched models of trauma recovery, prolonged exposure. And there's, you know, there's a number of different recovery models, but that's one that I'm trained in and that I've used with a lot of clients. But I've combined that prolonged exposure with this concept of replaying those enactments with a trusted partner, someone that the person can trust to negotiate with, to talk with them about. And I want to be really clear, this is very controversial stuff that I'm talking about. This is all very new. I presented it at a conference for the first time just a few months ago, and it was very well received. But there's a lot of work to do to validate this as a model. There's a lot of research. So this is a theoretical construct at this point. But what I'm seeing so far is that it's showing a very effective response, similar to kind of an EMDR sort of experience, if people are familiar with that, where they're very immediately engaging, only in this sense, instead of an emotional engagement, it's a physical engagement. So I'll stop there because I think I just threw a whole lot of material at people.
Wow, no, that was great.
Do a round of questions.
Sounds good. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm learning lots. Okay, let's go to Dr.
I hope I didn't
Dr.
freak people
Deb.
Out too much.
No. Not me. I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else. But anyway, Dr. Deb, you're on with Andrew. Hello?
I had to unmute my own phone, so sorry about that.
Come back, Deborah, come back.
I was outside in my hammock, and I walked to my freezer, and you're like, you're on. I'm like, oh.
You love that hammock. You're in that hammock a lot.
I am in my hammock a lot. I love my hammock. I love the sunbathing, and it gets me vitamin D. It makes me happy.
Well, as we all know, vitamin D is the cure for COVID.
Oh, well, it should be. It's frozen. I'm on the air. Hold on.
Is that your son?
My son, he sees that I'm making pizza for dinner, and he's like, that's frozen. I said, no, because that's my cauliflower pizza. I make his from scratch. So I'm like, he's just being nosy. Being nosy. Wow. But anyway... You know, it's interesting because I hear you talk a lot, Andrew, about the arousal factor, and people don't get it. The first time that you talked about that at the script conference, I had tons of people come up to me saying, who's that Andrew? And I said, Andrew Parry? They go, yeah, we've never... they never have heard someone actually get out there and explain that to somebody.
Right.
Because most people feel the guilt. They feel all the stuff, and they're trying to reclaim that. People have so much guilt about even reclaiming what was going on. And my question is, and I think I tried to explain this to my class after you spoke last year, but it's different for women than it is for men, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think psychologically there's a lot of crossover and a lot of similarity. Physiologically, there's some differences. I mean, clearly with men, the arousal process is a lot more obvious. And so it's easier, especially if we're talking about child victimization, it's much easier for a predator or a groomer to use that against them because it's a much more obvious response. An erection is easier to see than vaginal lubrication. So I think there's that element as well that can be used as a great shaming device. Oh, well, you know, you're aroused, you're erect, you're into this, and there's, I think, more of that. Not that women don't also go through that. They do as well, but I think it's a much more obvious process for a man. There's some hormonal differences that I go into as well about how men process arousal versus women. But I think there's much more connection than there is difference in terms of the psychological damage that it does and the emotional damage of having that experience. I think, you know, there's also for men, there's the societal difference of men are always supposed to be up for it. Men are always ready to have sex. That it's a mark of masculinity to, you know, do that. And so I think there's that level as well, where if they don't want that and they don't want it with that person and they don't want it in that way, there is that, I think, shameful sense of, for men, well, I'm supposed to want it because everyone tells me that. And I think that's a whole another division between men and women, whereas women are, I think, more allowed to not want. And, you know, there's those stereotypical masculine-feminine differences in that sense.
Yeah, women have more of a shameful factor of it, you know, and it's interesting because when you get into people having fantasies or you get to the history of, you know, how we are basically, I don't know, socialized, right, in that way, it becomes very different, especially depending on who the perpetrator is, too. Of all of that and how people respond to it, you know? And I'm wondering, like, you know, in your clinical practice, like, I'm just curious, like, when women do disclose to you and men disclose to you, like, is your response different? Because I know mine is, you know, when they start disclosing, like, how I respond to them, is it based, you know, based on society or is it based on my gut at the moment, you know? And it's interesting because it really, I really tailor it to the client, like, how I respond. And I do always say thank you. And you tailor it to the client.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I just had the experience earlier this week of thanking a client for being vulnerable enough to disclose something that was clearly very painful for them. As far as how I treat, you know, like I said earlier, I primarily treat girls and women. I occasionally will have a male client. But I'm not off the top of my head aware of treating them differently because of their sex, but treating them differently because of their individual experience. And so just taking in their experience, because I work with sex workers, lesbian clients, trans clients, and so I'm much more attuned to that human's individual experience of what they're going through, because I may talk to two different women who have similar experiences, but very different results out of that, very different ways they feel about it and think about it. You know, they may have been both abused as children at 8 years old. What they grew up with or what they came out of that with might be very different. So I try to tune into those individual experiences and differences.
Yeah, that's very similar to me. No, it's very similar to what I do.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I treat men and you treat only women. And I do treat transgender too. And so that does make a huge difference when I'm in the room with them. So thank you.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Deb. That was great. And now we go on with Bill. Bill, you're on with Andrew.
Right. Thanks a lot. I'm not sure where I want to go, Andrew, to be honest. There's so many topics, and I'm not sure that I want to take a lot of time like Johnny did. Although I'm sorry he left. I think he was a good contributor to this show, especially as another male.
I was interested in your take on that kind of chasing the high concept together with what I said. I was interested in your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, I mean, I was unencumbered with any socialization about sex. I didn't know anything about sex when it started. Never been mentioned to me before. I didn't even know the word. And then I was trapped in a situation for an entire month where I couldn't query anybody what was going on. And the guy that was molesting me easily caused me to be aroused. I mean, I had a hard on all the whole time, you know.
Right.
But I couldn't ejaculate, but I could have the sensation. And this was just mind-blowing, literally, to me. And I did chase the sensation when I left his presence and I went home. This was at a summer camp, I should explain. When I went home after the month, I experimented on myself trying to reclaim that sensation. And I could get little pieces of it, but I couldn't get the entire experience. In fact, I never got it again. But I was really, the next month, again, abused by the same man. Meantime, I hadn't said anything. I had a sense something was wrong, because now I was hearing on the playground about faggots and gay guys and all this, and I knew I knew male to male. Something there was something wrong about male to male, and with, you know, at least what I was learning on the playground, nothing else. But I went back the next summer, and the next summer the experience was a little different. In fact, each summer something was a little different about it. The next summer I went into it, you know, eager to see if he could recreate what I'd experienced the first summer. Of course he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
The next year was a completely different experience, but in between those 2 years, I was even harder on myself physically, trying to get a reaction. And I really even tortured my penis, you know, and my testicles and all kinds of things, trying to see what, I was desperate, you know. And in the third year, I was kidnapped and offered for trafficking and all kinds of other things. And as soon as that was over, I disclosed. But I chose a person that was not trustworthy. It was a psychologist who taught psychology in the local college, but he was also the prefect and counselor who lived with us in the boys' school. And I was a freshman in high school. I went right to him. It took me about 3 weeks maybe to decide I was going to go to him and talk about it. And when I did, I told him the whole story. And I thought I was getting help. And instead, I had told another predator. The next 2 years were hell, because I was running away from consistent, you know, engagements with other kinds of men. They were all men. And I really didn't have experience with women until I was in my 20s, well into my 20s, frankly. But here's the thing I did consider, and I'm not sure if it was wise or what, but I realized that the woman's experience was different than the man's experience. And I related what I had experienced in that first month to be more similar to what I imagined, and this is an imagination, women were experiencing. Because as we know, women can have the experience of the arousal and the climax, actually, over a long period of time, and they don't have it like for 2 seconds and then it stops. You know,
true,
can have it like all evening if you do it right, you know. And kind of what I had. So I had just a little bit of a window into maybe how the female was felt. Now, I don't know if they feel the same way, but that their arousal was protracted, whereas the male arousal in normal circumstances, you know, is a kind of a quick sensation. The final sensation is a very, and we are chasing that. And it's a final sensation that when it's over, you know, it's over for a brief period of time. And we lose our erection and we lose our interest. All that goes on. Lots of things go on. I am reptilian, no question about my sexuality. I dare anyone to say they're not. but I guess I would make that comment about, you know, about your query.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point to make, and clarification about what women are capable of sexually when they're aroused versus what men are. And that does create a very different experience for women than it does for men.
Right. But that's nature. It's okay with me. I don't have a problem with it. You know, the point is, when it began, I was not socialized. We're always talking about how men are socialized different than women. I had no socialization about anything. You know, I mean, I had a sister, and I knew we were physically different, but nobody had ever explained sex to me, ever, or reproduction to me, or anything, you know, or how babies. I mean, I kind of had an idea, but I didn't have any information at all, zero, when it first started. So,
Well, that's sadly true for most of America, I think, still today, in terms of what we teach children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I agree. I'm all for detailed, age-appropriate sex information and reproductive information and so forth all the way through the school system. I'm all for that. It's not happening, wish it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. All right.
You bet.
Okay, we're just down to two on the panel. So We are going to go back. Andrew, you have about 18 minutes for another section and another panel, and then sort of closing for you. How's that?
Okay. All right.
All right.
Oh, I think I'm going to jump back into what I was talking about with this this trauma model, because I think there is a lot of potential for it. And the idea of being able to immediately address trauma symptoms by a guided recreation of the event. And just in case people are wondering like what that would look like, it's a lot of psychoeducation and discussion in the therapy room and talking about what that would look like, talking about what the original event was, and then what the person is seeking to reclaim or to redo. And I think reclaiming is a really, you know, excellent word to use for this. And then the idea is that they would either have or find a trusted partner to negotiate what that scene would look like. And I say scene because I'm bringing together, in a sense, kind of two different worlds, and I want to talk about that as well. I'm finding myself over the last year having a lot of conversations about what I consider the conservative mainstream sexual assault recovery world and the lived experience and knowledge that is in the BDSM and kink world. And I think a lot of people who have had some type of abusive experiences find their way into that world because it is open and accepting in a way that my field, psychotherapy and psychology, historically has not always been. And I talked, you know, even just to me, what is a very tame subject about arousal, I still hear many clients that I see unable to talk about it, being shamed by other therapists not understanding what that is or how that works. Mm-hmm. And so if you take that to, you know, this much greater degree of I'm replaying my trauma with people either on dates or Tinder or FetLife or hookups, and I'm doing that, I think there's, you know, there might be me and a handful of other people who understand that process and why people might pursue that. So there's a great deal of consent and negotiation that needs to go into this process. It's not just something to try out or jump into. There's a lot of potential for damage and danger in doing that. So I'm always very clear when I talk about this to point that out, that it really needs that guided therapeutic piece. So the idea is to negotiate what that might look like, even bringing in the other partner to talk about what that could look like, then they would go and do the enactment. The therapist is not a part of that. I want to be really clear about that, that it doesn't happen until, you know, that happens in their own lives, in their own room, apartment, wherever. And then she would come back into therapy to process that experience of what happened, to talk about either the reduction in symptoms or what the experience was like. Did she reclaim what she was looking to reclaim, what aspects of the trauma were brought up because of that. And mixed in there's a lot of grounding work. There's a lot of comfort work that the other partner needs to be trained in doing. So this is a process. This is not just, you know, let's try this out and do it. It's a much more nuanced process than that. But one of the things that I've uncovered in working with this world with I think I said earlier, a lot of this community is on Reddit in a group called Rape Kink, is really understanding that there is so much from that kink world that is important for us to understand in the psych world. And I'm a member of several communities in the psychotherapy world that is beginning to look at the healing power for trauma in sex play and in kink expression. And in fact, I've been invited to put together a training around how people can use kink to be able to heal from trauma. And I'm going to be doing that later this summer with an organization called Tashra. It's going to be a webinar because of COVID. So it's going to be a 4-hour webinar at the end of June. talking about these principles, talking about how kink and BDSM sexual play can be used as a healing tool for trauma survivors to recover. So it's some very new, very edgy stuff. So I'm very excited to be putting this together.
Wow. That does sound new. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, I said that does sound new, and it sounds very promising, actually. About how long do the sessions take? I mean, in terms of weeks or for this to actually help?
Right. That's a great question.
If I know what I'm asking.
I don't have an answer. It's very much in theoretical stages. So I'm starting to work some of the concepts out with a very few people I'm working with. Really, the next stage for me is finding a cohort of survivors willing to engage in this to be able to answer some of those questions. But roughly, I would say a few months, 3 or 4 months, but that's really just off the top of my head. I do think it would shorten the typical treatment experience, like just working in the office. I typically find 2 to 3 years to be a rough average in working through a lot of trauma.
Wow.
So again, it's a theory, it's an idea. Wow. I'm experimenting with it.
Well, I'm glad you're doing that. That is, you know, we need something else that's going to work.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. Okay.
Sure.
Well, let's go to Dr. Deb back again and see what she has for you. Okay, Dr. Deb, you're on with Andrew.
Curious question. I mean, you talk about this whole, you know, program that you're creating and therapeutic, you know, tool. Have you ever thought about putting that into a book? Like, you know, because I, personally, I would buy it. I would, because I would be so fascinated, but I'd want to help my clients in this way.
Now, this is where a number of issues comes up for me. I live in terror that some of these ideas I come up with, and you and I have had this conversation about, you know, professional image versus ideas that make sense. And so even just talking about the need to recognize that there's a gap between kind of the known conservative sexual recovery movement and the lived world of the kink community, just even putting those two things in the same sentence, I worry that people are going to mishear and take the wrong way. And, I mean, I've talked for, Deborah knows this, and I've talked in the show before about just writing a book about arousal, and I'm still working to get to that point. So this is a whole other magnitude level beyond that. But I also don't think I'd be comfortable doing that until I had some really, you know, solid information that I would feel comfortable, you know, putting out there, because I already know, even just talking about this, you know, I have a fear that someone, you know, is listening at home and they're like, oh, I'm going to try this out myself without any therapy, without any consult, and hurt themselves and create more damage and more trauma. And that's the last thing that I want. This is, you know, meant to be a helpful therapeutic technique, but it does have a lot of risk to it. So as far as like writing anything down officially at this point, I think I need more research, more time to kind of study and figure this out. So that's my answer.
Yeah, that was the next place I was going, like, have you researched this? Because, you know, one of the things I love to do is get a minion of mine, one of my students, and make their dissertation. Like, research this. Find out if this has worked. Find out if the clinicians would want to see what things will go in there. You know, because it's fascinating, because one of the things that I've learned, just because the rest of the world isn't in step with me doesn't mean there's not a place for it. And if that's who you are, then let them talk. They're going to talk about all kinds of things. They talked about Freud. And you know what? He was onto something. They talked about Masters and Johnsons, and they were onto something.
Right.
So put it out there. I mean, I know it's a struggle. I struggle with it myself. But I think there's a lot of people who would get something out of this, you know?
If you're remotely comparing me to Masters and Johnson, I'm going to freak out like a little girl and run around and scream in joy.
I was.
That's very flattering. Especially coming from you.
Well,
I really think this is a great idea. So I think you really should pursue something.
You know, in the professional world, I'm getting a lot of validation for it. So I know it's something that needs to be pushed forward. But the mainstream, you know, you always worry about what the news media is going to do with something and twist it around and make it sound awful. And, oh, he's suggesting that. I actually had a colleague say this to me. She said, "So it sounds like you're suggesting that rape is the cure for rape. You might be onto something." But I think in the wrong hands, it could really sound something other than what it really is.
Yeah, I get that. I completely understand it. But you'll find the middle ground, you know. But if it was wacky, I would tell you. You know, I'm one of the most blunt people you've ever met.
I know you
so
would.
I would tell you.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. Actually, for a book, Andrew, I was thinking you would write one for professionals because you don't want somebody trying this at home.
Yeah.
Do not try this at home.
No, I think.
Okay.
Right. Absolutely.
Oh, Bill, you're on with Andrew.
Okay. Andrew, can you clarify what you just said, that one word sounds like the other? I didn't hear the two words. One was rape, I think. What was the other?
One word sounds like the other? World. I was talking about the gap between worlds, I think, that I was talking about the mainstream rape recovery kind of cycle.
You just said a phrase about how people might think that rape was talking about rape, but I think one of the words was not rape.
No.
Both of the words were rape.
This is a female colleague who said to me when I was presenting my ideas, she said, "Oh, that's really interesting. It sounds like you're proposing that rape is the cure for rape." She went on to say you might be onto something with that. So she was positive about it, but she was being coy in how she phrased it.
Well, no, there's a lot of sexologists, you know, that would agree with that. I'm not a doctor, by the way. If anybody's listening, I have no letters after my name, zero. I'm just a guy, but I have a lot of experience, life experience, and a lot of recovery.
You have a lot of information, Bill. Yeah, I wouldn't shortchange you on that.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying, want to say, I'm not in that same position that you and Dr. Deb are, but I am in a very unique position because I lead, you know, what I consider to be, you know, a very important effort here at NASCA. I founded it. I can tell you that I'm familiar with what you're talking about and that a lot of the concepts you're talking about are right on. The whole negotiation stuff you're talking about, the care for each other, the roles that are played with the person that's more dominant or sadistic and the person that's more masochistic or submissive are defined. They're talked about. There is a lot of trust. There are many the word scene is from the lifestyle world. Meaning there are people in BDSM, in the BDSM world, that consider it what they call a lifestyle. It's a way of living, and they take it very seriously. And they, too, have to be very protective about saying anything. You know, in many, many circles, you can't say anything. So they are they protect themselves by staying in a community, sort of. I'm familiar with this, and I'm, you know, happy to talk to you about it. But, you know, it's a touchy subject for anybody to get into because it is very, very easily, quickly misunderstood. And if you're in a vulnerable spot, like I suppose Andrew and Dr. Deb might be, I understand, you know, that you have to proceed with caution and with a lot of caveats because you don't want to damage your reputation or the work that you're doing in the process of coming to a new enlightenment. It's there. I know it's there. And, you know, we could talk another time about it, Andrew, but this is it's an exciting thing. It's about time thing, to be honest. It's about time.
I completely agree with you there.
This is not new. This is not new. It's been going on forever.
Right.
It's always been in the shadows, or actually in the dark. It's in the dark.
Yeah.
It's done, like you say, in a person's home, an apartment, in a dungeon, at a party, at maybe a club. It's never done in public. It's never done. It's done at conventions now. There are conventions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's communities that are more and more open.
That's right.
There's the sex positive world, sex positive Los Angeles. There's I sit on the board of an organization called the Center for Positive Sexuality, and I'm their certification program director for a program called the Sex Positive Professional Certification Program. And one of the things that we talk about in that learning program is understanding the BDSM and the kink world and the positivity that it can bring, and kind of neutralizing a lot of the fear and suspicion that people have about that. Because at the end of the day, it's really just sex play, which is positive and which is good.
Feared. I'm here to say it's not to be feared. It's not for everybody, obviously.
Right.
But it's not to be feared. There is no conflict. The people who have the lifestyle type lifestyle have no problem with people who have the more conventional or normal, if you want, sexual lifestyle at all. None. Zero.
Right.
There's no conflict and there's no fear.
And I think even beyond no fear, I'm learning in these last number of years, there's a wealth of information and learning that the psychology field really needs to look into.
And I'm
very fortunate with groups like Tashra and groups like Karis, which are professional psychotherapists dedicated to doing the research and doing studies around the relation between kink and sexuality and human sexual expression, and then starting to look, as I am, at some of these links between kink and trauma, and is there a healing element there, and how do we identify that? I think there's a wealth of knowledge yet to be plumbed.
Oh, it's deep and wide and historical. I mean, it goes back centuries, really, but even just in our lifetime, it's been there forever, and there is a tremendous amount to learn, a tremendous amount. I applaud you. And this discussion is, you know, hopefully mind-opening for some people who are listening tonight. And appreciate your being here, of course, Andrew.
Thank you. Well, it's fascinating to me that I'll present at certain conferences and people will just sort of be nodding and yes, that makes sense. And I'm talking about like more, you know, kink-centered conferences. I talk at a straight psychology conference and I could hear like the pearl clutching and the gasps in the audience from my colleagues and professional people. What are you talking about? So there's a lot of bridges to build.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Okay, we've got about a minute left about a minute and a half for any closing statements that you would like to share with us, Andrew.
If people and like what I'm saying and want to get in contact with me, they're interested in, you know, talking about or being a part of this, reach out to me. And when I say this, I mean, you know, any of the stuff we've talked about today, from the Me Too book and finding out it's published by PCCS Books out of England. Easy to find on the internet if you look up Me Too PCCS Books. And people are interested in talking about my research, they can reach me through my website, www.saawareness.com. And my contact info is on there. My email is on there. My email is andrew@saawareness.com. So I'm easy to find.
Very cool. Thank you. And I'm very encouraged by your angle that you're coming up with, because so far I have not run into anybody, any therapist who has anything as novel as that. And dare I say, helpful as that. So
I'm building a reputation.
I'm very impressed,
as being
a
taboo therapist.
The taboo therapist. Yeah. Well, pretty soon it won't be quite so taboo, and then it won't have the traumatic effect that it's had.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much, and I wanted to thank Dr. Deb and Bill, just turning them on for this last second to say goodbye to you. Okay, Dr. Deb, you're on. Bill, you're on to say goodbye to Andrew, and then we are closing.
Andrew, goodbye. I'll talk to you later.
Take care.
Andrew, thanks a lot. You did a terrific job, and Deborah, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. God bless.
Thank you, Bill, for all of your input, and thank you, Joe, for hosting.
You're welcome, and thank you for being here. And now we are just closing with blessings to all children and blessings to all survivors of child abuse. Good night.
Oh, no. that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.